Hello, for this episode of the podcast about the last analog generation, sandwiched between Gen X and millennials, I've decided to go freestyle, off-piste, by inviting the award-winning journalist, content king, and Gen Extraordinaire, Matt Potter. Welcome to Zennials. Matt, you are a journalist for the BBC and the Washington Post, filmmaker, broadcaster, non-fiction author, very inquisitive too. Your work on everything from the 90s free market explosion to smuggling, politics and cybercrime really explores the deep trends, shifts and changes happening beneath the surface. I'm delighted to have you on this podcast.
I'm delighted to be here.
And Matt, to start this conversation, I want you to reflect on the fact that in 1990, Time magazine described Gen Xers like you as bulking at work and unable to make decisions with attention spans as short as one zap of a TV dial. Sounds familiar?
What's not to like, right, about that? But actually, in all seriousness, there's 2 points about that, which is, one, there's a reference very similar to that, to attention span, and the young no longer honour their parents in the Bible. Socrates has talked about this. Every generation sees the next generation as hopelessly feckless and hopelessly exotic. And there's always that phrase, what is it, to each generation, it considers itself wiser than the one after it, but more intelligent than the one before it. And I think, for me, what was interesting about being a Gen Xer was not people were telling us, the same as people are telling Gen Zs now, people were telling us that, but how loud that was, it cannot be overstated, because of the fact that we were quite a small generation, and the baby boomers were this huge bulge in the pipe. And anyone who wants to look at the history of the 20th century or the late 20th century can see that, you know, it can be explained by that bulge in the pipe, sort of being able to out-volume everything else. And when it wanted filofaxes and shares, then there were the 80s. And when it wanted rebellion, and there were the 60s. And when it wants its country borders there, because they're now old, that you got the 2010s. However, being a Gen Xer was about being absolutely, I mean, the size differential in those generations and growing up in the shadow of it. You were being told over and over again how none of the music you like, none of your culture is valid in any way, because it will never be like the 60s, mate. You were being told that nothing that you had, that none of your technology was valid, because it will never be like we had it. But really loudly, because of that, there were three of them to one of us. And people talked about not wanting to work, and we were called the slackers, you know, and there were all these movies like Kevin Smith's Clerks, and Beck, you know, I'm a loser baby, so why don't you kill me? And Nirvana saying, you know, just for goodness sake, what can we do? And I think that's because there was nothing we could do but shrug and walk off. Our vote didn't mean as much as the baby boomers' votes. We had a situationist view. We could ironize, which is why lots of early 90s...
Which people can't really do these days.
Right.
Like, the sound of it. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, which is why a lot of, you know, whether you take, you know, Beck or Nirvana, it was all very much about, well, that's what you say, mate, but what about this? And we could, you know, like the situationists, we realised that we couldn't stop, you know, Guy Debord's, you know, barrage. But what we could do was we could subvert it, which is why that was the age of ad busters.
Yeah, I just want to go back.
Yeah, go on.
To the point you made about this simmering anger almost.
Oh, yeah.
At the fact that previous generations thought they'd done so much more than Gen Xers.
Yeah.
And they had lived a golden era and kept repeating it. I hadn't thought about it that way, actually. For me, the general angst and sense of irony of Gen Xers was what came from the fact that a lot of Gen Xers are latchkey kids.
Yeah.
Lot of them grew up in, single parent families because divorce rates were soaring in the 60s and 70s. And
I'm being told not to get too attached to anything. Because if you think about it, we can still remember the Cold War. You know, the 80s, our first times we could remember were full of people going, go to bed tonight, kiss everything goodbye just in case. And it was like, wow, okay, so things are really ephemeral. Things are really not worth becoming emotionally invested in.
I didn't have that sense growing up as a Zennial.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, I literally witnessed the fall on the Berlin Wall when I was quite young.
Yeah, awesome. I hate the fact that you've just said you can remember it because you were quite young, because I was on my gap year in Germany.
Oh my goodness. What was it like at the time?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, the funny thing is that it caught everybody by surprise. So people talk about the dissolution of the Soviet Empire and all of these things as if it was like,
We knew it was crumbling. We knew the empire was crumbling.
But only in the same way that we know the climate is changing, but nobody expects like the earth to catch fire very suddenly on a November evening. So there was this whole sense of like, something's happening. And then suddenly the Berlin Wall came out, right? And it was just like, for people in Germany, it was like, oh, bloody hell, we didn't expect that. And it's like, but you did expect that. Yeah, but not tonight, not now. And so there was this whole sudden, I remember this whole sudden scrambling for a reaction. This whole feeling of history's kind of pointing at us right now, and we don't know what to do with this moment. And it caught so many people in the West off guard, just like it caught the border guards off guard.
That's a very interesting point. And also the fact that I think in the late 80s, you start seeing the emergence of round the clock news where everything is televised and everything becomes a collective experience, because literally, I think it was one of the deeply historical moments that people could actually witness.
Oh, yeah.
The sofa.
Oh, it was that changed everything. So the point where you got the Berlin Wall, here we are live at the Berlin Wall, and here we are live in the first Gulf War. And suddenly they were big televisual moments. And it was quite odd to see, in the sense that there were two things that you noticed. The first thing, I mean, I think it was Sky News, or in 92, I think, created the first UK-based rolling news station. And it was really odd, because you noticed that people needed suddenly to come up with something. They all felt they needed, it was no longer the case that you could say to a politician, what do you think? And the politician would go, well, we're going to retreat to Chequers for 48 hours, and by Monday we shall have an opinion. It was like, what do you think now, here? Which is why we got that was the birth, if you like, of these great kind of the rhetoric first. Give them the soundbite, as George W. Bush called it, the vision thing. Right, give them that now, and then we'll think about it later. And you can see the apotheosis of this when you've got people like Boris Johnson just going, we're going to, and blurting something out, and then everybody scrambling to make that real or make that true. So there was this sudden power of the image in real time. And then the other thing it did, I think, is along with that, and I want to talk about the change to Zennials, because along with that, what I could see at the same time was this sudden visibility in the world. As mobile telephony, as the internet suddenly came on, and the internet, we've all seen those graphs of expansion, and by like 95, it was like, okay, now we're talking, this is an actual thing that the population's doing at large. That made people visible and made young people visible in a way that we could see as Gen Xers. Late Gen Xer. We could see, oh my goodness, look at this. People like I was 5 years ago are now able to have their opinions heard unmediated.
I think that's yet again an important point here. The fact that younger generations have a voice. More
absolutely.
Than previous ones.
Absolutely. And I think we were the I think it's wonderful. I'm a big kind of neophyte. I've got great hope in this kind of this capacity for vocalization. That the thing that almost I had to live through, which was just the people who owned the channels got to tell you the way it was going to be, isn't the case. So you suddenly get the idea that, well, things, policies can be crowdsourced, or, we're good, right? And that was never the case before. So I loved that. But you're right. And I do feel like I'm one of the last kind of kings of the dark ages before everybody goes, right, well, it all starts with William the Conqueror. And I'm like, we were there too. You know, and I always feel like that last bit of invisibility before the sudden explosion.
I get you. I mean, it's great to have a voice, but you need to have something to say, and that's a different matter. Anyway, moving on. I want you to tell me your thoughts on my little venture here. I'm trying to understand what creates or constitutes a micro generation, whether you think it's relevant or not. And I'm going to tell you a little story. I've got something to share here with the audience, how this whole project started. One summer, a couple of years ago, I traveled back to my small town in southern Brittany with my family. And I was, as you do, at the market, Le Marché, on a Saturday morning with husband and kids. And I bumped into an old flame. Teenage flame.
Yeah.
And we start chatting a little bit, slightly awkward, as you can imagine. And then he starts talking about a friend who sadly ended his life.
Mm.
And in his group of friends, I'm not sure I'm going to keep this for this recording, but I want to share the story anyway.
Do it.
In his group of friends, a lot of people suffered from depression.
Yeah.
A lot of people suffered from breakdowns and mental health issues. I could not feel that so much in my generation or in subsequent generations.
Yeah.
So that's when I started to reflect on what made Gen Xers in particular so depressed. And then I looked into statistics.
Yeah.
And the ONS, the organization, is it? The Office of National Statistics, says that Gen Xers are more prone to suicides, depression, substance abuse, and any other generation.
And that's only the good bits. No, that's kidding.
No, I don't want it too dark
here. No, you're absolutely right.
But clearly there's a generational
problem. There absolutely is. And the funny thing is, you know, we talk about, for example, the male suicide epidemic.
Yeah.
What people don't talk about so much is the fact that it is a specifically very much a Gen X male suicide epidemic. The wave follows that generation through. So it was teenagers when I was a teenager. It's been very, very odd. And you're absolutely right. There are things around, you know, you're going to charge me £100 an hour now for talking about this because you're becoming my therapist. But there are things around being without currency, without value. There are things around being the latchkey kid. There are things around being closed out of a culture that is supposed to be yours. That point about Radio One, about the youth, that's not just a frivolous point. That is the feeling that we had growing up, that all of the things we were, children's programs, pop radio, all of these things were still very much owned by and telling you all about this golden period that was the 60s, that nothing you can ever do will ever be as good as that. So I think there's a real sense that we were formed by a group of people who were high on the fumes of their own myth. And I think, you know, the latchkey thing is part of that. I think there were people who, bless them, I understand, there was a social change afoot. Both parents were suddenly working. Great, right? Great. But I think both parents were throwing themselves into, now we need to work. And the kids became this encumbrance, a burden, rather than a, you know, that is an asset. And I think that was potentially quite a moment. And then I just genuinely don't think you can underestimate the power of growing up in the shadow of duck and cover commercials for nuclear war. You cannot.
You see, I did not experience it.
No, you did. Exactly. That's
I did
that's
not have flip, that. So that's why we didn't have that constant sense of anxiety.
We're talking about today's eco-anxiety, related to AI and digital acceleration, as if it's something completely new. Previous generations had that too.
Absolutely. And I think there was a very odd moment. So there's a wonderful book called Culture of Fear Revisited by a guy, he's a fairly fringe academic, called Frank Furedi. In the book's worth reading. In the book, it talks about how much safer the world became between the 50s and the 2000s. In real terms, at least in most
long-term development trends, when it comes to
absolutely.
Violence,
we live longer, fewer diseases will kill us, absolutely. Even look at cancer, you know, that's now a treatable thing, etc. He talks about the anxiety, the idea of fear, and that the idea of fear, when it stopped being about the things that would definitely probably, you know, kill you or one of your siblings, child mortality, that it became, that didn't stop being passed down by parents to their kids, but it became a free floating thing that was waiting to, the idea of you're at risk, we're all at risk, you're at risk of this, you're at risk of that. You know, you'd see it everywhere.
Hang on a second. Did you not write a book called...
We Are All Targets. I did, absolutely.
Okay, so I want you now to tell me more about that, about the fact that you have tried to explore this sense of menace, of threat.
And that
is within society.
That's a really good point.
And maybe that's a real Gen X thing as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, and you
tell us more.
You will know because you know, you're a creative like me. You're creative. Albert Camus once said, "Every man's work is a slow detour through the slow trek through the detours of his art to discover the two or three great and simple images in whose presence his heart first opened." And the fact is, I may have garbled it slightly, but he was writing in French.
Something like that.
Right, yeah. And the fact is that when you write a book or when you become a journalist or when you do any piece of some art or any piece of creative, what you can do is you can sit down, or when you're a songwriter, you can sit down after a while and go, here is my, that's the theme, isn't it? Right. So I've written this out. I've written three books. First one was about arms trafficking and the sudden flooding of the world with guns and drugs in the wake of the Soviet collapse. Right.
Rock and roll.
Rock. Okay. And in fact, rock. The second one was a social history of the resignation letter. The only epitaph we get to write for ourselves and so on. The third one was about cybercrime, the birth of cybercrime in Yugoslavia in the late 90s. Now, all of those, I realise all of them are basically a look at the 90s and a look at what's happened to us since then and a look at the world deregulated, a world which we are now told we live in, without borders, in which somebody over there can do something, you know, the butterfly can flap its wings, and it's very easy to imagine the tornado in Texas. You know, and it's this world I'm trying to make sense of when, in the words of Burger King, you know, have it your way. It's your right, you, the customer, you, or in the words of Thomas Friedman, you know, one vote equals $1 and $1 equals one vote. And if you suddenly have a world in which, and we talked about visibility, you know, in which everybody has a voice, and nothing matters except what the consumer wants, then you have something that you have to live by different rules than the ones in the past.
And it's possibly also because you and I grew up during peak globalization. Apparently it happened in real economic terms, not until the start of COVID, actually, or just before COVID happened. But ideologically, we were already reaching some of its limits. But we live through the era of overconsumption.
Absolutely.
Of powerful multinationals like Enron.
Oh, yeah.
Burger King and fast food culture and all those commercial messages that we were constantly inundated with.
And this was supposed to be, you know, and Tom Friedman of the New York Times has become a joke. You know, it's like, oh, the booster for globalization. Well, you know, oh, it's brilliant. The olive and the Lexus tree. The McDonald's theory. No country with a McDonald's has ever gone to war with another country with a McDonald's. Of course, it's not true.
But we grew up in this slight dystopian environment where, like I said, we're bombarded with those, messages.
Absolutely. Constantly. And we were
buy
bombarded
this,
with
find
them.
That and enjoy it. Be happy.
Absolutely. Be happy.
Buy that to be happy.
Exactly that. And that's why I think there's a lot of, if we think about kind of the Gen X Xennial changeover, and for me, I think this was one of the most exciting times, if I'm honest, as a later Gen X, was to see. It felt like suddenly seeing light flood the world, if I'm honest, because what you felt was, I've been living in the dark. I've been, you know, maybe I'm a freak. Maybe I like a certain kind of music. Maybe I have these secret thoughts. The internet coming along meant that I didn't feel like the solo zebra in the horse field.
The fact that globalization accelerates in the 90s can be a little bit scary for some. Right. But as far as I'm concerned, and that's my big thesis for Xennials, I think my microgeneration has benefited from globalization more than
absolutely
previous generations. It means
the shift is the interesting time as well. It's
so much happens then.
Yeah.
And it means that I've talked about it in an article actually I wrote recently, published on LinkedIn. Which talks about the fact that I'm a lower middle class kid, latchkey kid.
Yep.
I grew up in a small village in Brittany.
Yep.
I was able to study in the UK to start my career in London, working for American companies. I traveled the world. Of course, everyone does travel these days. But I was probably the first generation.
Absolutely.
I'm from the first generation. I was really able to grab all the opportunities of cheap travel.
And not just
democratization of, like I've said, of opportunities.
Yeah. It wasn't just physical travel, as you're saying, it wasn't just mobility, which I think we're talking about.
A cheap mobility.
Cheap mobility. Yeah. But it was also, if we think of one of the best things to happen for me that the Xennial generation brought in, and it happened with the 90s, and people don't talk enough about it, was that we all, that the let's say the subcultural tribes, suddenly the walls between them collapsed like the Berlin Wall. So because of blogs and so on, but partly just because rave culture, all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Ecstasy was a great help because it made the Sisters of Mercy and Prodigy and Trip Hop and Britpop all sound amazing.
I would never
recommend any of that. But all I'm saying is it was clearly it meant something. And there's this feeling. For a moment, I'm not going to go on about it. I'm not going to rave about it. But if you think about ecstasy as a, thank you, ecstasy culture. See, the Gen X comes with free dad jokes. But if we think about ecstasy and its influence on culture, just as a symbol, not to say it's pervasive, what that did was it creates a feeling, it's the Jungian feeling of like, we're in an oceanic soup. There's no border between me and you and the music.
Yeah, it's very egalitarian. You're right.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And it was like, you know, I can be mates with you and you and I can.
Yeah.
Right. And that collapsing of walls and borders. Yeah. And if we think about the whole kind of the 90s,
not just physical, but social.
And could have called the mind forged manacles that we wear, you know.
Yeah.
And so you got things like, and it did mean a lot to us at the time. You got things like, you know, Garbage and Tricky collaborating, or, you know, which was a grunge thing and a trip hop thing. And you'd think, this is really cool. And these became little hyperlinks.
There was a lot of mixing. Actually, I will talk about it in a different episode with a music expert.
Oh.
I can't say too much about it, but it should be a good one indeed. But I talked about cheap mobility.
Yeah.
But another feature of the 90s, as far as I'm concerned, from my perspective as a Xennial, is the fact that generally we had great access to culture.
Yeah.
And culture is very empowering when you are
absolutely
a lower middle class kid growing up in a small village.
Yeah.
It means that you can educate yourself easily, cheaply.
Absolutely.
And in the fashion you see fit. Of course, you've got school and you've got what's on TV, but there's much more beyond
that. And that is enfranchisement, and that is choice coming. You know, in the words of the Manic Street Preachers, libraries gave us power.
Very much so.
Right. And this is, people don't think about that enough. When they talk about we are overwhelmed by information. And again, that's an old thing that's gone back to the Socrates.
Yeah. They should feel blessed.
Right. But nobody says you have to take in all the information.
No,
it does mean that you can seek out your own path through information. And that's been tremendously empowering. I mean, at no other time and in no other world have I seen anything as exciting as what happened when the internet came online. Because before that, I'd be listening in my own lonely early teenage way to, let's say, a David Bowie album, and someone would go, you know, oh, that's the influence of Kabuki. And I'd go, what's Kabuki? And I'd go to the public library and I'd go, does anyone know where I can find her? Yeah, finally there's a reference. Okay, fine. Or let's say, right, Kabuki Theatre, no plays.
But
you can devour so much. You can be a magpie.
But there was an intention and there was a journey.
Yeah,
we were curious about culture because you still have, and that's the difference. And that's possibly why people do not appreciate it as much.
Mm.
Culture, although we had, I think, in the 90s, great access to it. Like I've said, we still had to go for it, to find it.
Yeah, I know, you're right.
And to often travel somewhere for it.
Yeah.
And that's the key difference. But there was a real appreciation for it. When this instant gratification culture, I remember having a subscription to, called that Mickey Mouse magazine, whatever. It would arrive every Friday. Yeah, right. I've been waiting for it all week.
When's the new drop date? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my
God. Amazing, it?
And it was a time of exploration.
Yeah.
And given the general cultural context today,
yeah,
there was space for being not always very politically correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was space for irony, certainly for sarcasm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nuance. Now, it's time to wrap up.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Matt, this could go on all day. I know. Very frustrating exercise for me. To wrap up, to sum up, the 1990s.
The 1990s.
What springs to your mind? What was it the decade of? How should it be remembered?
Ooh, how much do I love this question?
You have 2 minutes
right.
and a half.
For me, the 1990s was a decade of, like I said, it... literally and symbolically, walls being deleted and falling down. And the public and people and commentariat and so on scrambling to make sense of what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, one of the first and most naive things everybody would say about the Berlin Wall? Yes, the people there are finally free of their oppression. Right. That's your very simple take on that. The more interesting take is that we're going to have a longer, more drawn out, more messy process of assimilation and comparison of ideas and cultures and so on. And we're going to have to get used to that. And we're going to have to look at what's valuable in that. And it's the, I think it's been the same with the internet. You know, there was a lot of anxiety about that, about, you know, oh, brilliant. Now people can do things. There are bad things on it. You know, it's the same about social media now. And I think it was a time of great sudden exchange and the ability to see things. It was a time when people could find their tribe. And to me, that's why I loved it when, you know, the sort of social, when the idea of the hashtag, because that was about sticking up your little flag and going, this is the thing I want to talk about. Who's with me? Who wants to talk about that as well?
So this begs the question.
Yeah.
What was your tribe?
My tribe, as you've probably worked out during this, my tribe is magpies. My tribe has always been people who take the time to engage, to look beneath the surface of what is apparently going on and go, cool, what's really important here? And kind of to just remain interested in it all and to make out of it the tomorrow that we all deserve.
Matt Potter, the inquisitive Gen Xer. Same thing. Same tribe here. Indeed, same tribe. Okay, Matt, are you ready for the Zennial quiz?
I am. I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
All right, bring it on. Matt.
Yes, the quiz.
Composure. We're now going to talk about your favourite album of the 90s.
Oh, can I have two?
Of course.
Right. So I guess one of my most influential albums of the 90s was was Mellow Gold by Beck. I heard it and it was his foot and he came out and it sounded nothing like a professional album. It sounded nothing like it. It sounded like somebody arsing about with a bunch of things, doing a comb through paper and basically having fun. And to me, that was as valuable at the time as, and it was word drunk and it was
immature. Was going to say.
Yes, go on.
Chaotic but witty.
Chaotic, thank you. There was some real value in somebody almost like opening up the cupboard and going, see, it's all held together with string here. Yeah, anyone can do this. It was a very punky moment. So I thought that was really cool. And again, it was there was hip hop in there was folk, there was rock, there was all sorts of things. And the other one I'd say was, and this is an odd one, I used to love Trans Global Underground in the 90s and their albums that came out. So they were sort of like this global collective of, you know, they'd always be at a place called the Whirligig on Hammersmith High Street, where it was like kind of global beat, a bit of world music and masses and masses of rave. And
like
so rave was very freeing to all of us, I think. It was to me. The fact that you could, it just didn't matter. You could be one of the cool kids or not one of the cool kids, but in your combats and trainers and t-shirt, you were absolutely in this oceanic wonderful soup. So those are the two elms.
Remember Asian Dub Foundation?
Oh, I love Asian Dub Foundation.
Yeah. The second album reminded me of this.
Absolutely.
Nice. Okay, tell me about your favourite film of the 90s.
Oh, so can I tell you, there's one story about my least favourite film of the 90s, which I'll tell you before. Okay. So I went to see, so the 90s were quite weird because suddenly we had had, there was a sudden explosion after or around the time of things like Silence of the Lambs and The X-Files and so on. There was a sudden explosion of...
Oh, we haven't talked about The X-Files yet.
Oh, then ask me about my Seven Rides. Oh, my God. Right. But there was this sudden explosion of like, let's have a look at the dark underbelly of things. And for a while, there was serial killer Vogue, right?
Yeah.
It was, and there was Millennium, the TV show. Seven. There was all of Seven. There was other ones. Backdraft was, and I remember being outside the cinema, quite young, outside the cinema in Slough, which is, I'm not laughing at Slough because it's where I was born.
Glamorous.
Right, I know.
Glamorous
very,
Slough.
Very, very concrete. Very now Slough. So I was outside the cinema and we'd gone to see Silence of the Lambs. And me and my friends went, Silence of the Lambs, it's full. Okay, Backdraft, right? Donald Sutherland, can't go wrong. Oh, that's full as well. There's a serial killer in that. That's full. Oh, right. I've never heard of that, but it's called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. So why don't we go and see that? Because it can't be that different from Silence of the Lambs. Now, I got into that film and it was one of the great kind of like, it's filmed with a Super 8 camera, lo-fi type movies. But if you've not seen it, don't go and see it. It's so awfully, unrelentingly brutal and depressing that I left the cinema. It's the only time in my life I've ever left the cinema. But I think my favourite film would probably be, I think Dazed and Confused, the movie, was really good.
Favourite again.
We've talked, 90s. If anyone's watching this, we've talked about this earlier, The Pager.
Oh, The Pager.
The Pager.
What a nuisance.
The Pager claimed to be a liberation because you get to know that somebody, but it was not because it was almost like having an electronic tag because people would go, Matt, call me. You'd be sitting in the pub with your friend, Matt, call. They wouldn't tell you what they wanted, but they'd say, call me. And you'd have to go and find a phone box. Mm. So that was, I suppose, the emblematic one. Last thing, I will hurry. One of my fascinations is intermediate technologies. So the pager was your clear intermediate technology between.
I like that.
Right. And let's say page turners on the internet. Look, we've got a magazine, but it's on the internet. It's not a website, but you can still hear the sound of pages, paper. You know,
cute.
It was meant to explain to people who'd never had a thing.
Completely irrelevant right, now. Exactly. Very retro.
You know, what the new thing. Anyway, so okay, the pager.
I'm going to open Pandora's box here. Your favourite book.
Cool. No Logo.
Ah.
Favourite book of the 90s. No, I think I've got different. There are different novels. There's so many I could mention. But I think if we're talking about the 90s, then No Logo was absolutely this moment of great distillation of the thing that we all were thinking, which is the more people get onto, you know, the more the corporates want to take over. Of course, it's the first time coffee shops have been seen in Britain, proper coffee shops, the Seattle Coffee Co., which birthed, you know, which, you know, Starbucks and stuff. And the more these, again, this moment where people were going, hi, kids, I too am a trendy kid. You know, the more you realize that's actually not trendy, the more people are branding this downtown location.
It was a similar kind of book in France that became very successful. It was 99 Francs by Frederick Becbeder. And it was a reflection on the world of advertising and marketing. Yeah. One word to describe the decade, the 1990s.
Sample-tastic.
Oh, okay. A mix.
Yeah, you know. We could all patchwork our own identity.
Absolutely.
Up, right?
DIY culture.
Absolutely.
Make it your own.
Yeah, lo-fi DIY, just do it.
The world is yours.
Exactly.
Matt Potter, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Indeed.